Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 16th of November 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you all on board. And it's going to be a really exciting show this evening. Just before I bring my guests in, I just want to remind everybody that we don't provide financial or legal advice on this channel. This is just a general conversation. Do please play nice in the chat room. We do moderate the stream. This is as at the 16th of November, if you're watching replay. And if you want to ask a question, use that Walk the World to get my attention. That gets your question right at the top of the queue. And also, I've enabled Super Chat, which means that firstly, you can make sure that your question does get to the top of the queue using Super Chat. Or indeed, if you want to make a contribution to help us fund what we do, that would be great. We don't do this for profit. We do it because we care about what's going on. And we think there's some important debates to have. And with that introduction and without further ado, I'm going to bring Victor and Steve in. Steve, I think you've... let me just press that. What happened there? Hopefully now you're coming in. Let's have a look. Yeah, there you go. Hi, Steve.
Okay, there I am.
How are you doing?
Disappearing into the white there with the fuzzy background and fuzzy white hair as I get fuzzily older.
Yep. And you're calling in from where?
Bangkok.
Okay.
Long story. I'm coming back to Australia in January to re-enroll as an elector, and therefore to be able to stand as a candidate for the party in the Senate. Mm. And it'll be a permanent move. Of course, if I win, then Bangkok will go from being home to being a holiday home, which will be unexpected. But that's what John Lennon once said: life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And these are my other plans.
Excellent. Well, good to have you with us. Thank you very much for spending some time. And Victor, are you there?
I'm here. Yes.
Great. Okay. Great to have you. You're back on again. This is the third gig you've had on DFO.
It is. I feel very privileged, Martin. Thank you. Yes, the third gig for sure.
No, well, it's good to have everybody on. And Victor, can I just start with first question for you, because New Liberals. Training along, tracking along, but of course the incumbents have been throwing all sorts of roadblocks in the way, right? Increasing the number of votes you need to get registered and all those sorts of things. So just give us the short version of the hurdles that you've been navigating over the last few months.
Well, the short version is that they challenged us in the AEC on the basis that our name would be confusing. The AEC said, no, it's not confusing. The voters are not that stupid. And anyway, the Liberal Party of Australia can't, according to the precedent of three federal court judges, can't parcel up a generic political term like liberal and exercise proprietary rights over it. So we won that. So then the Liberal Party decided to overcome that by introducing legislation, which they got the Labor Party to support, and they rushed through the House in 24 hours saying that they could proprietize the word liberal. Quite literally, that if a party second in time came along and used a word or even a part of a word of a current party, that current party could seek to have them deregistered. Now, that applied to us. It also applied to the Liberal Democrats. Now, fortunately, the Liberal Democrats are challenging that in the High Court. So that's thrown a spanner in the works. And the nature of their challenge is that it interferes with the implied constitutional right of political communication to not be able to call yourself what you are. And of course, the particular irony is that we are a real Liberal Party as opposed to the Liberal Party of Australia, which is probably the most conservative party or conservative government in the Western world. What they tried to do, and that part of the new legislation applied directly to us, they also brought in another thing which was designed not just to knock us out, but all the other small and emerging parties. And that was that they suddenly tripled the membership requirements that you had to have, and they gave all these parties 3 months to triple their membership or they get deregistered. The idea was that they don't like the... And they got, the Labor Party supported that, of course, too, because they want to keep the duopoly as the thing that runs this country, and they don't want interference from these pesky little parties and these pesky emerging parties. So we had slightly more than our minimum that we were required to do. But we put out a call on Twitter and we got 1,400 new members in 48 hours. So we shot past the requirements for that, and we were very fortunate. Nonetheless, about 30 or 40 minor parties will be eliminated from running in the next federal election, which is not exactly what you'd call a proper democratic process, I think. That's where we're at the moment. And the battle goes on. We're winning at the moment, but I'm not getting complacent, that's for sure.
And it's just as an object lesson, isn't it, that the big parties, who frankly are closer together than more, you know, apart, despite what people might think, that they do everything they can to block effective debate and different ideas. It's very much trying to constrain and retain control.
Absolutely. I mean, it's what people are starting to call, I think, alternative autocracy. You can have this autocratic regime or that autocratic regime, and that's the nature of your choice. Mm. But if you want to try and, you know, support something different, then that will be prevented.
Absolutely. Well, see, let me come back across to you because, of course, you've published a book and you're also standing as a candidate as a new Liberal. So this is really now when economics and politics really collide, don't they?
They do. I mean, I just like you, Martin, I've been a critic of economic policy in Australia for decades. And of course, especially how it's applied to housing, and the basically destruction of our manufacturing sector, and so on. And I've been complaining about it, and it very much found myself tuning in with Victor when he said that a reason they formed the party was people are just disgusted by the state of Australian politics right now. So it's no longer a case that you might oppose the direction. For example, as much as I admire him as a person, John Hewson's economics was something I opposed back when he was running. But I admired him as a person, I admired his intellect, and he would be somebody happy to have sitting around this table having a conversation with us. If Morrison turned up, I'd show him in the back door as forcefully as possible. Get the hell out of here. The calibre of Australian, and it isn't just on the Liberals, it's worse on the Liberals, but the calibre is so low that I'm just disgusted by the state of it these days. I had no intention of becoming a candidate, but Victor's request when he began to be confident about the exposure we're getting that maybe it was worth standing for his House of Representatives seat where he lives in North Sydney, and he said, would you be willing to be the candidate? And I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. I'm disgusted by the way that our political system selects fundamentally incompetent narcissists. So let's try to get a chance for some relatively competent, empathic people to get in there instead. And you know, it's not the career I expected at the age of 68. It's not the one Victor expected at 70. But we're doing it because we can't handle the juvenile types who dominate Australian politics today.
And it's interesting, you know, that you got some nice coverage in Bloomberg on the economics front, but also, interestingly, on the fact you're running. Interesting that Bloomberg decided to cover it. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, as you'd be aware of yourself, Martin, from your own role on the housing bubble discussions in Australia, you and I end up on all those TV business TV shows. And so I've been interviewed by Bloomberg in Sydney two or three, maybe half a dozen times, I'm not really sure. So one of those journalists who knew me from those days, when he saw him running, oh, let's do a story about it, which was great. Now, the irony, you know, Victor talks in particular about the dominance of the media seen by Murdoch, but of course we've got the same unfortunate nonsense. See, the oligarchs control the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age these days. And even The Guardian, that's supposed to be independent, none of these venues whatsoever have covered us, but there we are in Bloomberg.
Exactly. Well, and you're on DFA, so the other point, just on while we're talking, Steve, is your new book, right? Which is out in e-form, I think, and will be out in published form quite soon. Called The New Economics, and this is effectively turning the conversation from, well, we know the problem is the economists don't know what they're doing, but this is basically a blueprint for an alternative.
Yeah. One reason neoclassical economics still exists is no alternative paradigms being thrown forward that is strong enough to replace them in every facet that matters in economics. And fundamentally, that's, if you go back to the foundations of the limits to growth study, that's what the expectations were of the engineers who designed this, the technology that supported limits to growth, that they thought economists would be pleased to be finally freed of having to think in equilibrium terms. So what I've done my own work in the last 20 years, I've developed a platform for dynamic non-equilibrium monetary modelling of the economy built on those foundations. And now I'm saying it can bring that in with knowledge of what climate change actually means. We can have an economics which is properly integrated with ecology and which asks the right questions and gives a proper modelling framework for the world we're in, rather than what I call the Ptolemaic world vision of neoclassical economists. So yeah, that's this book is the first step towards saying maybe as capitalism is about to die on the altar of neoclassical assumptions, maybe this is the way we should actually have modelled it for all along as a dynamic non-equilibrium monetary system.
And just to be clear, you know, neoliberal thought is basically very much market-driven, very much free market. But of course, we don't have that, right? What we've got is a massively skewed structure where it's effectively aligned to the interests of, you know, large rich corporations and the 1%, and everybody else has to sort of just basically tag along behind.
Yeah, well, even if we did have what neoclassical economists called a free market, it wouldn't operate the way neoclassical economists think it would. This is the point of my debunking economics. Their entire vision of how the world works, it isn't just a case of talking about competition when we actually have monopoly. That's why I use the Ptolemaic analogy all the time. I think you can look at neoclassical economics and see a direct descendant of Ptolemy's Earth-centric view of the universe. You know, they have a human-centric utility-maximizing view of what capitalism is about, and that's anything but what capitalism is about. So you've got to go from a Earth-centric to a sun-centric vision before we had decent astronomy, and a similar thing applies here. We've got to get away from their fetishes for thinking everything happens in equilibrium, leaving out the ecology, calling it an externality and trivializing that, not understanding social classes. Neoclassical economics is a very intricate mess, and unfortunately people who believe it can't see the messy parts of it. If you read the literature as I have, and you have the non-orthodox economists I'm part of, it's shot full of holes, but they evade all the holes and say, here's this beautiful little picture of how the world actually operates. Oh, sorry, guys, you're wrong.
Right, and so the Copernican revolution, right, which is what we need, is a different way of thinking about it. And this is precisely where economics and politics has to intersect, right, because essentially the thinking around economics has driven the political sphere. There's a bunch of other things, you know, people focusing on their own interests rather than community interests. But nevertheless, economics and politics very much glued. So, Vita, can I come back to you then and say, from a new liberal's perspective, where does the intersection of politics and economics sit in your mind?
It's almost everything. If you want to have, as we do, the best public education system in the world, if you want to have the best health system in the world, if you want to get 3.2 million people who are below the poverty line above the poverty line, if you want to create full employment, if you want to have a job guarantee scheme, you've got to have a system of economics that makes sense and that enables that to happen. And that's why it's so wonderful to have Steve on the team, not only as our senior policy advisor on economics, but as our number one Senate candidate for New South Wales, because we have a model that we believe can achieve these things and create a wealthy economy at the same time. Also think crucial things that Steve's working on at the moment in detail, affordable housing, which I know is, you know, dear to your heart, Martin. It's really hard to find, proper social security, a public bank. I mean, it's really hard to find something where the tentacles of economics don't underpin it and aren't crucially and fundamentally important. I mean, maybe something like whether refugees who've committed no crimes can be thrown into a dungeon for the rest of their lives. Maybe that doesn't require a knowledge of economics to say, well, that's inhumane. There are a few things like that. Economics touches on everything. Defence, it has to touch on defence because You know, do we want to defend ourselves, and how do we want to defend ourselves? And are we going to say that's limited by cost, that's limited by the taxation we can raise, or are we going to say that, you know, a sovereign government can invest in that and in education and in health and all the other thing and in putting people to work? I think, you know, when people say, how do you differ from the various other parties? I tend to say in every possible way, because our economics enables us to do a range of things across every aspect of the polity that other parties don't. So it's not, for me, it's not even an intersection, it's an intertwining. The two things are the two faces of the coin, if you like. They're, you can't have one without the other.
And that's really important, right? Because I'm a philosopher by training, and I always want to know what are the underlying assumptions that are driving people's behaviours and actions, right?
Yes.
And so there are a range of economic assumptions and presumptions that are driving a whole bunch of things in terms of policies that are actually being executed. But if you start picking at those assumptions, which is, Steve, precisely what you do, then you start realising that those assumptions are not valid and therefore the policies are not valid, right?
Exactly. I mean, I had this argument with actually Lindsay Tanner in the Labor Party way, way back in the 80s. So I wasn't formally in the Labor Party, but I found myself working with a couple of trade unions and as advisor, and I was caught up in some of the early discussions over the Accord, and I was involved in writing some parts of it when it was like an attempt to a Nordic industrial policy proposal rather than a wage restraint, which is what the economists in the Treasury turned it into. But Lindsay was saying all the way through, we to get over the Whitlam curse, we have to show we're better economic managers than the Liberals are. So what we should do is marry first-year economics fundamentally to progressive social policies. And I said, look, first-year economics is a myth. If you do this sort of stuff, you might get away with it for a while, but it'll come crashing down around you. And what you'll end up doing is delegitimizing those social policies by the failure of the economics you bring about. And that's the thing where we've ended up. We have an incredibly unequal society now, with a manufacturing sector that's been decimated by a range of policy, including Whitlam's 25% tariff cut. And then all the, you know, it's houses and holes is a summary for the Australian economy these days. And we're now dominated by fossil fuel interests. As you say, the politics, the economics, it's given us a form of paper prosperity, but it's made us an extremely fragile nation for a time when robustness is by far the most important thing to have.
Mm. And I guess that takes us to the sort of the critical question, right? So if we start seeing that the way things currently are aren't working, and you know, you can pretty much look at it in terms of the wealth inequality, the lack of you know, real investment in the things that actually lay a foundation for the future. But there's lots of money available for, you know, things that the incumbent government wants to do. They're still throwing lots of money at, you know, big oil, big coal and those sorts of things. The point is there are choices that people can make and are making, right? Except that those choices are often dressed up as we've got to do this because there's no alternative, right? Well, there are alternatives.
I think about that. They've got to do it because there's no alternative, which gets them the same level of funding they want. And I think this is one of the reasons that, like a central theme in Victor's approach to all this, has been anti-corruption, and defining corruption much more widely than a certain Scott Morrison might do. But the corruption that comes out of using your control of the government purse to, you know, put a few commuter car parks in, you know, remote underdeveloped regions of the country like Toorak, you know, because you want to make sure your Liberal Party candidate gets up. So they're using the power of the government to create money that they themselves don't understand to keep themselves in power, not to help build a sustainable society. So that the combination, it's economics, politics and corruption all in one. And to take on any of those, you've got to take on the lot. And one of the most important, I think, is, if not the most important in the early stages, is to get rid of this institutionalised corruption that now characterises Australian politics.
Right. And, you know, when the former Premier of New South Wales says nothing wrong with pork barreling. You know, that's just that's the way that politics is done. And when
everybody
you look-
does it. Well, that's the reason to get rid of everybody. and this is the tragic thing. They can't even see it. I mean, when you're so immersed in it, you can't see your behaviour as corrupt, and it's time you got chucked out of office.
Mm. But the interesting question, Victor, I'll come back to you, is that to wrought change, clearly you have to be able to engage with and become effectively part of the political system and process. But a question for you is, to what extent do you have to compromise on those ideals just to get in the game?
Well, you can't. That's the point. This is the thinking that they propagate that sucks in every emerging movement or party. You have to compromise to get in the game. Well, history shows us that once you compromise, you're theirs. You're in their pocket and you become part of the game and nothing changes. See, we came at this. We're all non-careerist politicians. As Steve said, I'm 70 years of age. You know, like if I was wanted to be a careerist politician, I might have started a bit sooner, you know. But we saw our democracy slipping out the bum end. And, I've lost the track. What was the original question?
So the question was, can you be true to your ideals or do you, by definition, have to effectively compromise to play in the game?
You can't. So what we said right from the beginning is we're not going to compromise our ideals. And if the people... because we're still a democracy and people still have the right to vote. And if the people find that admirable and vote us in, so much the better. But if it really is quite literally impossible unless you compromise your ideals, then we will lose and we'll go back to our day jobs. But we don't believe the latter for a moment, because if that was the case, history would not have happened. History is the study of change, and change happens and we need another change and we're hoping to bring it. But we're not going to bring it. The idea that this is the thing around the Labor Party supporters at the moment, the idea that you sell all your principles down the river so that you can get into Parliament to enforce your principles is is the statement of pure madness, you know. So for better or for worse, we're not and we won't.
So that takes us then to the obvious next question, which is, you're basically putting candidates up in both houses, effectively. The games are rather different, though, in the two houses, aren't they, in the way you have to play the game?
Yeah. Obviously, Steve is our, prime candidate for the New South Wales Senate, and he can't be campaigning on the streets. To 5 million people, it's not possible. So the Senate is something where you have to get your message out as a global thing on, wonderful shows like this, and people vote for you. And one of the things I think Steve loves is that, we do have a proportional representation situation in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It may not be quite the European system, but it's a system whereby if you get sometimes as low as 10% of the vote, and other people preference you, then you have a candidate in the parliament. Lower house, of course, is a much different thing.
Mm. What I'm thinking, there've been changes since I've been overseas since 2014, which is why I've got to come back and re-enroll to vote before I can become a candidate. But it also, of course, we had that the preference whispering stage, and one of the reforms, and it actually is a decent reform from what I can see, to that was that you can now vote in the Senate either for all the candidates by name below the line or above the line, at least six parties. Is that correct? I think that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. You can vote, well, that's weird. You can vote six above the line and 12 below the line, but that's a recommendation. If you vote more than three above the line or more than six below the line, but not the number you're supposed to rate, it doesn't invalidate your vote.
Oh, so you can actually just put 1, 2, 3 and that'll be okay.
That is not complying with the legislation, but there's a catchphrase in there, the catch clause in there that says it still doesn't invalidate it. So it's a bit...
Well, see, that gives us a lot of flexibility because what we're saying is whatever happens, we're going to preference the Liberal Party last. So we haven't yet developed our Senate ticket, but that'll be like a guarantee. And I think it might as well be iron rigid. I'll even put Fred Nile above the Liberals, you know, because Fred Nile's not going to get anywhere anyway. So you put the Liberal Party last, and then the other one, if we put a how to vote, it's got to have, say, 1 to 6 to qualify. And what I expect we'll do is, our party, of course, number one, and then Labor Party 6, and presumably the Greens above them, and the group that Simon Holmes-Accord?
Holmes-Accord, yeah.
Has put together. So there's people like that that is common spirits with us. We'll give our preferences there. But it'd be quite possible, like if we do 1 to 6 like that, we don't even put the Liberal Party in.
No.
Which would mean that therefore the Liberal Party doesn't get any distribution from us. Now, of course, individuals can themselves say, I'll vote for you first of all, but I can't bring myself to vote Labor. Remember the old Don's party with the woman who's, it's an emotional thing, she couldn't vote Labor until after the party. Well, you might say, well, even if you're a Liberal voter, okay, you put them there, but put us above them. At least put a genuine Liberal party prior to the conservative, reactionary, religious junket or junta that has taken over what used to be called Liberal Party.
Right. So the story then in the Senate is, interesting and preference-led. But what about the lower house victory? It's a bit different there, isn't it?
It is different, and it's going to be fascinating. I mean, in the seat where I'm running in North Sydney, so this is a seat where we assess that there are a large number of moderate, disaffected Liberal voters who may vote for us. There's also a very strong independent candidate, as Steve mentioned, that Simon Holmes-Accord's Climate 200 is backing. There's the concept that's getting about amongst Labor and Greens voters in these Liberal-held seats that instead of trudging along knowing their vote will be wasted, they're tending to look at us and say, we would say that we're far more progressive than the Labor Party and probably more progressive than the Greens. But whether you think that or not, if you vote for one of those two parties and you know your vote's going to be wasted, maybe you vote for the new Liberals because we have a real chance of knocking the incumbent out. And these voices of movements that are throwing up well-funded independents are starting to stand in all the key Liberal seats across the country. I think there's well in excess of 30 Liberal seats that are under attack either from us or from a well-funded progressive independent or both. The next parliament could be a very different, it's altogether possible. And you've got things like the Greens who are knocking on the doors of several lower house seats in Melbourne, came within a whisker last time, plus Brisbane. You could quite literally have a crossbench consisting of 12 independents, 6 Greens and 3 or 4 new Liberals. Now, a crossbench of that size is barely even a crossbench. It's almost an opposition, and I think that the lower house phenomenon, the independents have proven they can do it with Zali Steggall knocking out former Prime Minister Aberdeen, with Helen Haynes knocking out Sophie Mirabella. Sorry, her the person before her, Kathy McGowan. Helen Haynes succeeded her. It's all up for grabs. I mean, I have people writing to me every day saying our family were in a state of hopelessness. There was no alternative to vote for. They're saying, now you're an alternative. What's more, there are other alternatives. And, I think I look at it this way. If you take your power for granted as the duopoly has done in this country, it's like a business that takes its profit margin for granted and doesn't pay any attention to its customers and doesn't update its product and just assumes that its successful business, which was built up by hard work, in the 1890s in the case of the Labor Party, in the 1940s in the case of the Liberal Party, will just go on forever because that's the natural state of things. But the customer says no. You're not delivering anything that we can relate to anymore. You're not delivering anything that we can use. And if you do that, alternative businesses grow up. In this case, you know, the New Liberals, the independent movements, other progressive parties. So the lower house situation is quite dynamic. And I think if what I am projecting actually happens, that will be the death knell of the duopoly. Because a lot of people who aren't willing to take that up say to me, well, yes, Labor's terrible, but they're slightly better than Liberals, and they're the only hope in a two-party system. They don't get it yet that it's not going to be a two-party system. Once they see that people like us, like independents, like the Greens can make great inroads, then they will abandon the duopoly in droves. And I predict that 2025, both the so-called major parties of today will be mere rumps of themselves. We've got a very exciting political future ahead of us.
So that's very interesting, because you have on one side, you know, the ideological view of you need to drive change, et cetera, et cetera. And the other side, of course, is that a lot of voters ultimately, when they go to the ballot box, are driven by the hip pocket nerve and perhaps, you know, thinking very short term about what's in it for me. How do you shift the conversation away from hip pocket nerve and, you know, short-termism to something more maybe idealistic? Maybe that's the wrong word. I mean, that's a really important conversation point there, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think what you have is competing human fundamentals here. People are driven by hip pocket nerve. I think my own personal view is they're driven more by the fear that the parties engender in them. You know, there's a certain school of marketing that says the best way to sell something is to make people feel frightened if they don't have it. And I think a lot of it, like vote for us or the refugees will all swarm in and kill you in your beds, you know, vote for us or the Reds will get us, you know, vote for us, or all that sort of. And I think hip pocket nerve is there's something deeper than hip pocket nerve. Vote for us or you'll be poor. Vote for us or you'll be starving. Vote for us or you'll be like those 3.2 million people below the poverty line. So I think that's a fundamental that people need to be able to overcome their fear and so on. But what they also need is the other side of the coin. They need trust. So if we can present the competing argument, you know, they say there's only two real emotions, love and fear. If we bring in the love, if you like, it sounds a bit hippie, we bring in the love through a bit of trust. If they say, well, because you ask anybody and they say, oh, yes, yes, but we don't trust any of the bastards. If we can show that we're trustworthy, that we're not careerist politicians, that we're in this because we do care and we don't want to see our democracy go sliding out the bum end and become the new Argentina, if we can counter that generation of fear with a generation of trust and love, I think that's a battle for the ages, you know. And I think it may well come from now. It's incremental. I'm not saying we're going to sweep into government in May of next year, but I think we can begin the journey, and then things gallop after that. Once you get the toe in the door, things go up. And I guess it's a long-winded way of saying, I guess we're going to counter it by not countering it. We're just going to be ourselves and say we're real people, we do real things, we have real expertise, we have as advisors some of the world's leading people in their field, like Steve, and several others like him, not just national leaders in their field, but world leaders in their field. You want a bit of trust that. You know, if we make an economic decision, it comes from one of the world's leading economists, not from some backroom compilation of people of faceless men, as they used to say. So gosh, I'm pretty much getting onto the battle of good and evil here, so I'll stop.
but there is something fundamentally important here, right? In other words, we can't go on the way we're going on because we know where that leads, right? We know that if you continue to play the same deck of cards again and again and expect a different outcome, it ain't going to work. So
Einstein's definition of madness.
Well, yeah. it is, isn't it? And we also see on the ground, you know, I see it in my surveys with a lot of people under financial stress with very low interest rates at the moment. We see the manufacturing sector being eroded. We see, you know, central bankers doing nutty things with low interest rates. And we see the Treasury and the Reserve Bank and the APRA and everybody else colluding effectively on a particular economic model that's driving a lot of outcomes, which isn't actually helping the real economy. So the stakes are really high, which means that there is an opportunity. But I got to say to you, one of the questions that came up from a number of people before the show was, you know, without mentioning anyone in particular, there are wealthy individuals out there with political ambitions and very, very deep pockets who want to cruel the pitch. How important do you think is that? And what are the reactions that we should be looking at to try and avoid that happening?
I assume you're talking about Palmer.
I think that's a fair assumption.
Well, Palmer spent, I think it was $80 million last time to not win a seat. But people say, well, that doesn't matter. That wasn't his intention. His intention was to funnel votes back to the Liberal Party. I have my doubts about how much that effectively worked. I don't think Palmer's that clever. I don't think his ego's that small. I think Palmer wanted to win 100 seats. He didn't. I don't know how much he funneled back. I think it's a bit of a myth. But even if he did and people fell for that, I don't know they're going to fall for it twice. You know, there is a fundamental difference between people like Scott Morrison and Palmer with his new leader, Craig Kelly. Scott Morrison, you know, is perhaps someone that I don't particularly like, and I assume that is not particularly liked by Steve or yourself, but you've got to give the devil his due. You know, he's a clever guy and he speaks well. Now, Palmer and Craig Kelly are large oafs, you know, and large oafs, you can put a lot of money behind a large oaf and they're still a large oaf, you know, and people see that. There's a tendency to underestimate the voting public to a ridiculous degree. Sure, there are a lot of naive people there and there are people that are swayed by all sorts of crazy stuff that we would hope they weren't swayed by. But, you know, it helps to be John F. Kennedy and it helps to be Justin Trudeau and the other end of that long spectrum is oafs like Palmer and Kelly. You know, they've got a lot to overcome. And if you are a right-wing person who doesn't think the Liberal Party's right-wing enough, then you'll vote for One Nation. They're already well-established and they have a significant base. I don't think there's room for a couple of ageing oafs to come in there and do any damage to the Australian politics. I hope I'm right.
Wow. You've also got the other damaging oaf, who is Rupert Murdoch. Okay. Now, he will be in there, and I think we can expect to have an enormous amount of dirt thrown at us by the Murdoch press if they start to see us having any significant impact upon the electoral outcome, and particularly if this involves the challenging fossil fuel interests as well. So we're going to get a lot of fuck from them.
At the moment their attitude, and this has been made clear on air by people like Peter Credlin, who when people have tried to speak about it, she says, stop, don't give them any air. I mean, quite literally said that a couple of times on her program. Their idea at the moment is they can deal with us by not giving us air. But we're growing so quickly, I think Steve's right. Eventually they'll have to get to the point where they will start hammering us. We've identified three or four full-time trolls on Twitter whose full-time job is just to do and say nasty things about us. Now, whether they come from the Labor Party or the Liberal Party or Murdoch, I don't know, but they're definitely happening and they're definitely intent on doing their job well. So it's starting. But, I mean, my own personal view is bring it on, you know, because the old saying, any publicity is good publicity, I think really does apply in politics. We have had a couple of shocking pieces of press, and after each one, we've had a surge in membership, people joining as members, you know. So because we get named, and then people do their own research in the modern world. They're used to Googling. Oh, who are these new liberals? Let's go there. Google new liberals, comes up top of the line, looks at the web page, you know. So, yeah, interesting.
So it sounds to me as though what you're saying in a nutshell is we're not going to sort of play the same game as those guys. We're going to follow the policy, you know, effectively take the policy high ground, which means that we need to talk about the policies and perhaps we can go through a few of those. And maybe we can start with the, you know, the elephant in the room, if I can call it that, which is the debt problem. Steve, I know you've been writing on this for years and years and years, and you've thought very deeply about it. What's your take on what the policy settings need to be effectively dealing with the debt problem?
Well, the debt problem is not the debt problem. This is the issue. The problem is not government debt, it's private debt. And that is the framing by the Labor Party and the Liberal Party is all about we're indebting future generations by, you know, mortgaging their futures by borrowing money now, so it's better if we run government surpluses, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, this is how Victor came to approach me to be the economic advisor, because I'm one of a number of people, and not the only one, not even the only Australian. There's people like Stephen Hale and Bill Mitchell, of course, who are also involved in developing what's called modern monetary theory. But that is fundamentally an accounting view of how money is created, that when you take a look at the accounting, it says the government's not borrowing, it's creating money. The idea that if you and I want money and we don't have it, then we have to borrow from a bank or from, you know, an individual. The government doesn't have the money, it creates it, and it creates it by running a deficit. And this is where the accounting of modern monetary theory shows that quite clearly, that government spending actually creates not just money for the private sector, because if the government spends more on the private sector than it taxes the private sector, it's net putting money into private sector bank accounts. But to do that, that's a liability of the banking sector. To do that, it also has to put identical sum into the reserve accounts of the banks. And then when the government sells bonds, which is what is seen as creating debt, that is another form of asset to back the deposits that have already been created. And the bonds normally earn a positive rate of interest and can be traded. And so what we're saying to the banking sector when you sell government bonds is, would you like to swap reserves, which you can't trade and which don't pay interest, for bonds, which you can trade and which do pay interest? Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Three bags full, sir. So consequently, every last time there's been a bond issue, it's been oversubscribed. There's no possibility the bond's not being sold. That doesn't actually create the money anyway. So all this focus on the level of government debt is just a total furphy. And what really matters, and this is what my own economic analysis is about, and I know you've seen the same stuff, Martin, from your work on the housing system, is that what matters is private debt. When a private non-bank individual or company borrows, it's because they don't have the money otherwise. If they can't service it, they go bankrupt. And it's the dynamics of private debt that matter, and that's what we want to change the conversation to.
Mm. One of the things I keep saying, Steve, is that, you know, the private debt effectively creates debt slaves, doesn't it? So effectively, people are just paying and paying and paying, and basically they don't now think about paying off the mortgage. It's just servicing the mortgage, and all of the conversations about mortgage serviceability, but the debt's still there. And of course, those cash flows which run into the future creates hugely powerful and profitable financial services company, but at what cost to the broader economy?
Yeah, I mean, you've got all this money spinning around in the financial sector, not turning up in the real economy. And we've got, you know, incredibly developed superannuation systems and all the financial engineering, but there's almost no real, not almost rather, there's very trivial, relatively trivial amount of actual engineering taking place, when that's what we need for the future. And particularly when we're approaching serious climate change, we need different energy systems, and we need to be able to manufacture a lot of stuff locally, because I frankly don't think international supply chains are going to last the next two decades. We have to have a manufacturing capability as well. We have to have the technological skills to go with that. And all that awareness is something which is quite common in the party. I'm very pleased with talking with the other candidates and with the advisors. They're all aware of this need to get Australia off the floor, because over the last 30 or 40 years of good economic management, the outcome of that is Australia's level of industrial sophistication has fallen below that of Senegal, Mozambique, and almost Zimbabwe. Now, those are not countries, as much as they're rather good countries, and they're not ones you like to associate Australia's sophistication level with, but we are so far down the chain in industrial capability that those are our neighbours. So we want to reverse that direction and get to the stage where we actually have a skilled workforce, a skilled industrial base, and economic policy which doesn't undercut that, and the focus on reducing government debt actually undercuts the capacity to create the education system and create the infrastructure that enables those industries to develop.
Right, but I guess the other question, Steve, is, we know we've saddled private individuals and households with massive amounts of debt, and most of it mortgages on inflated properties,
yeah.
Right? That is going to be a huge legacy, negative legacy, a drag for a long, long time. So how do we deal with that particular issue? What's the levers that we can pull to try and begin to turn that around?
Well, actually, I've got two sets of levers. Now, one lever, and I want to show there's more than just one person talking about it. Let's grab this book here. Ignore the person's last name. I find it quite hilarious that Richard, you can see the name. Let's see. Okay. I've got a background effect getting in the way here.
Richard Vague.
Vague. Okay, a debt jubilee. And Richard he won't tell me how much he's worth. He's a good friend. I'm sure he's a billionaire. He ran two major financial companies in Texas, and then became aware, because he was actually handling credit card debt, aware of the huge level of mortgage debt before the financial crisis, then was saying to a mainstream economist, is this a problem, you know, this huge level of mortgage debt? Oh, no, look, they've got a huge amount of debt, but their assets have gone up so much in value, you know, that counteracts the debt. And Richard just didn't swallow it. So he actually sold his credit card company, I think, to Barclays just before the crash. So he's come out and said the real problem is the level of private debt. We have to find a way to reduce it. And he's one of several people proposing a debt jubilee. And the same idea is something which I'm putting forward as part of Liberal Party, new Liberal Party policy, and that is a modern debt jubilee, using the state's capacity to create money to give people fiat-based money that must be used to reduce their credit-based money debt. And we've worked out, working with Victor on this, we've worked out a scheme which could actually result in falling house prices without falling household equity. So we could bring house prices down without reducing the equity people have in their homes, make the houses more affordable, and reduce the level of household debt pretty much to zero by swapping it temporarily with government debt. And the impact of doing that would actually be not that there are issues in stimulating the economy in a time of global warming, but would actually give a boost to the economy, because you reduce the debt slave problem you were talking about. People would spend more freely, more money would be spent by the poor rather than the rich, and you'd have a form of economic growth boom coming out of that, which could actually reduce the debt to GDP ratios of both the government and the private sector. So it's a difficult project to sell, given the total mentality on we've got to reduce the debt directly, and that the government debt's the one to get down. We're saying, no, it's the private debt you've got to reduce. And you could do that by initially increasing government debt, which is not debt. It's money creation. So we face a difficult sell, but that's the direction we're going in. And I believe I've got a scheme, which I'm still working on the nuts and bolts of, that could mean we eliminate household debt, stimulate the economy, reduce the level of inequality without reducing the wealth that people have accumulated through the housing bubble in terms of the equity they have in their homes.
Right. And interestingly, of course, then people say, yeah, but hang on a moment, what happens if you don't hold debt? So are we bailing out those who actually got in over their heads? In other words,
No, that's why I call it a modern debt jubilee. Yep. This was put in about a decade ago.
Yep.
When I was first saying we have to reduce level of debt, people said, what about those who haven't borrowed and speculated? Mm. I'm one of them, of course. I've bought houses to live in, and I've sold them, having left the country. So I'm one somebody with no debt, but no housing assets either. What we would do is give everybody an identical amount of money. So Jamie Packer would get the same amount of money that I get out of this scheme. And then you could pay your debt down. Now, for the people who don't have any debt, they get a cash injection. And my initial proposal I worked out, which is in the context of the American economy, was to reduce the level of corporate debt. And again, working with some of the advisors in the party, who said, well, corporations at the moment are actually borrowing to pay down their equity. How are you going to convert that around? So we're now reworking the proposal to say that the money creation we generate could be used by people as part of their deposit to get out of rental and go into buying a house in a context in which we also help to reduce house prices. So, definitely everybody gets the same amount. And that's, again, in that sense, that fundamentally is the direction of the new Liberals. It's all about equity. We would give everybody an identical amount of government-created money to reduce the level of private sector debt.
And I guess the question then is, well, does that change the role of the banks and the finance system, right? Because, of course, they are there at the moment. They're just basically large-scale building societies, not a lot else.
Exactly. I mean, the banks used to have intelligent people running them. I know because my father was one. And friends of mine, mining engineers, used to be involved in evaluating mining projects for banks. So banks should be lending for consumption items which we necessarily need funding for. So you buy a new car for most people, or you buy a house for almost everybody, you've got to borrow for that. But stick it to consumption. It's housing as a consumption item, not housing as an investment. Fundamentally, you want them to be providing working capital for corporations and funding for entrepreneurs. That'd be the proper role of private banking. But because it's so easy to make money by lending, you know, for bricks and mortar, that's what they've become. And they give flyby valuations, drive past valuations, are the basis now of deciding whether you give a housing loan. It's disgusting, and it actually has caused the bubble we're trying to prick. So you need to limit banks and say, for the privilege of having a banking license, we are going to require you not to cause asset bubbles and to provide finance to corporations that need it for working capital, to entrepreneurs, and work out a way that that's profitable for banks as well, and for consumption, but not for asset speculation. And that all banks have been doing for the last 20 or 30 years is financing asset speculation. And that's why, and governments have been assisting them with things like quantitative easing. So we're in a bubble world, we want to get out of it, and we have some idea of how to do that.
And the point there, Steve, of course, is that, because you said a few years ago house prices could well fall at some point, right? I've been saying the same thing. But we are, of course, fighting a whole machine, which is to take interest rates lower, lend ever more, and basically create this stratospheric level of debt, which means that the rest of the economy is debilitated.
Yeah, and like it's people, because the discussion is always about government debt, what is the level of government debt right now in Australia? It's something like about 50% of GDP, 60%. Mm. Private debt's 220% of GDP.
Yep.
It just makes me laugh. If you imagine just showing a chart to a doctor and you compare the one chart and the other chart, which line should you be worried about? Oh, the one going stratospheric. Oh, no, it's the one down the bottom that's pretty flat we're really worried about. Bloody hell.
And Victor, let me come back to you, because there's two things I want to develop from what Steve has said. The first is investing more in SMEs, for example, you know, the engine of the economy, because at the moment very few SMEs can get the funding they need from the banking system, because the banking system is too busy just throwing money at mortgage holders.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the policy we're developing on that actually springs out of, I think, Martin, the first time I was on this show. Mm. And we were chatting about that very situation. What we talked about then and what the party has since talked about, that was the springboard for, is you've got two problems. There's a massive amount of bureaucracy that crushes small business. And then there's the situation where, as I think you said at the time, small business can get to a certain level, but when it wants to take the next leap, there's no support for it. And it's and people who try to make that leap are just as likely to bankrupt themselves as a sovereign government who wants to see a functioning economy. We would be breaking down that bureaucracy that they have to deal with, that technicality, that all that sort of stuff that people have to sit at their desk for days, you know, to get their BAS out, and all the other things that they have to do. And we would invest in entrepreneurial small business that wanted to diversify or grow itself or move on, because if you pump all your government assistance into the large multinational corporate sector, particularly when you do it by way of tax breaks that do not create any more manufacturing productivity but just enable people to have a lot longer and more expensive lunches, you're not really doing much for the large corporate sector. You're doing nothing for small business. And it's all about concentrating everything in the hands of fewer and fewer people, be they fewer and fewer government parties or fewer and fewer corporations. So it'd be a big part of our push. I mean, I find it close to nauseating when the Liberal Party of Australia talk about being the party for small business, when everything they do hampers small business from growing. And you have a situation where a large number of small business people are really themselves below the poverty line, and that's the terrible thing. So, yes, very important part of what we want to do on the financial side of things.
Mm. Well, certainly my SME surveys, and I survey them regularly, highlight that people just cannot get ahead, right? And they're tied up with the red tape, absolutely right. But also the whole funding and innovation model is actually wrong. And in fact, they have to jump through such extended hoops to try and get funding relative to, you know, mortgage funding, yes, that it's not surprising that many of them just are giving up. And, you know, without that, we don't have the depth of and breadth of in the economy, as Steve mentioned earlier on. The other question that sort of flows on from that, though, is... what about the conduct of government? And, you know, somebody asked earlier on, and I got it in the question beforehand, about, you know, an ICAC at the, or equivalent at the federal level. In other words, how do we actually police ourselves, politically speaking, and have the right conduct and processes and systems? And is the ICAC the way to go?
Yes, but provided you understand what you're saying by ICAC. So we came out with this idea of an ICAC, and I think we may have invented the term an ICAC with teeth. And we use the word teeth as a kind of shorthand way of saying an ICAC that would have the power to investigate and prosecute, and then via a separate constitutionally created court for the prosecution of corrupt practices, would try people before judge and jury, and if found guilty, sentence them to terms of imprisonment. That's what we meant by an ICAC with teeth. Since then... Helen Haynes, the Independent, the Greens, the Labor Party, and even the Liberal Party have brought out their models of the ICAC. Now, the Liberal Party one can be dismissed immediately. It's a joke. It actually, if you read it closely, it actually has provisions to protect politicians from any sort of prosecution. The other three are fine as far as they go, but they have no teeth. They call them. They steal our term and say, you know, it's an ICAC with teeth, but they have no teeth in the sense that they are talking shops only. They're what's commonly called an ongoing Royal Commission. Now, a Royal Commission was once upon a time a really powerful thing. In the days before Trump and post-shame and, you know, flagrant corruption and so on, if a Royal Commissioner said that a certain Minister of the Crown had done something improper, the Minister of the Crown would resign immediately. Nowadays, they just write it out, they laugh it out, they go to Rupert to make sure that it's all smoothed out in the press, and then they go on. We all know that Royal Commissions are absolutely useless talking shops. Now, that's what they all want because they're all frightened of being prosecuted themselves. We have the luxury of being clean skins, so we have the luxury of being able to say that one of the fundamental reasons that people have lost faith in our democracy is they know how corrupt it is. And they know that they, or they think there is nothing they can do about it. So if we say to the people, So we're proposing this, and it's quite draconian. I don't resile from that, and it's particularly draconian because it's retrospective. And as a barrister, I understand the dangers of retrospectivity. But you know, if we say to the people, we know why you're upset. We know why you're cranky. It's because your politicians are letting you down. They're laughing in your face as they steal your money, and do all sorts of other corrupt things. Vote for us, we will put those bastards behind bars. And if they do vote for us and we do put them behind bars, then they can say, well, you know, it was my vote that did this. And if they know that their vote did that, redress the balance and created some level of justice in society, then they have faith in democracy again. But anything short of that where they're, you know, we're just talking a bunch of words and nothing happens. We're clucking our tongues and nothing happens. That doesn't restore faith in democracy. So I think that not only is the ICAC important, it's kind of crucial. We talk about it as being, for example, our number one policy, and we're really careful to say, of course, climate change is the number one policy for everybody in the entire world and has to be, but if you have a corrupt system and you don't deal with that, nothing will happen on climate change. So in a weird way, the number one policy has to be the introduction of that ICAC with teeth and real action and real consequences. Otherwise, nothing will change.
Well, I'll come on to the climate change conversation in a few minutes as we get towards the end of the show. I can hear a pussycat there, Steve. And
yes, I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
I decided to wake up and join the conversation.
No, exactly right.
Nana, the family talker.
I locked mine out. She's banging on the door.
Dogs have masters, cats have servants.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we actually have the occasional doggy interludes here as well, so that's no problem. But Smooth Operator actually asked, I think, quite an interesting and important question. And Smooth, thanks for the super chat there. High private debt causes speculation, so would higher interest rates be better and stop the problem? So this is a question, I guess, for both of you, but let's maybe start with Steve. Steve, high interest rates, you know, do interest rates need to go up, or is that, you know, part of the problem rather than the solution?
If you try putting interest rates up now, you'd send a lot of people bankrupt pretty damn quickly, and I think we're going to find that if that actually happens. I have my doubt that it's going to occur. Interest rates can't control speculation, because if you say we're going to charge you 1% more for your money when you think you're going to double your money in 2 years, you're going to laugh. What actually makes you gamble and speculate is expectations of capital gain. And that's what the real motive force has been. And the capital gain itself has been caused by the money that people have borrowed to buy housing in the first place. There's positive feedback between the rate of growth of household debt and the level of house prices. So you have to break that nexus to stop that bubble occurring. And that involves legal changes, how banks can lend, as well as the idea of a debt jubilee. But you have to get people away from thinking in terms of being speculators. We don't want speculators, we want innovators. And there's a very big difference between the two. And everything we've had in Australia's polity has been pushing two major interest groups, miners and speculators. And we've got to control both.
And so this whole idea of, you know, an era of speculation, I'm just thinking of in the context of things like, you know, Bitcoin, which is sort of the current incarnation, property before it, probably in stocks and shares, right? We seem to have speculative bubbles all over the place. I guess the question I've got for you, Steve, is it really a natural fallout from, if you like, the neoclassical, neoliberal view that that's where you end up?
In a sense, because they ignore the problem. I mean, this is the thing which people who aren't trained in economics and haven't read any literature to have a hard time believing, because they think economists must be experts on money because that's what economics is about. Now, I can give you the authority, pardon the sarcastic inverted commas around that, of Paul Krugman, who in the Nobel Prize winner in economics, one of the leading textbook writers, New York Times columnist, very influential, is now doing a masterclass on economics. And as part of the promo for that, he says, economics is about people. It's not about money. Okay. So they actually leave money out of their models. Now, what that means is it leaves the financial sector free to go and do what it damn well likes. And what it likes is making large buckets of money by convincing you to take on large buckets of debt. So in a sense, it isn't because neoliberalism encourages that. It's because it ignores it. And that's actually been used as excellent cover by the financial sector to take over the global economy.
Right. So there is, if you like, a purpose behind the way things have been running for the last 30, 40 years. Deregulation, you know, the ever more power hungry financial sector, who has a huge influence then on the way that politicians behave. And in fact, you know, they're some of the most powerful lobbyists, which sort of begs the question then, well, how do we deal with that? And how do we actually change the game so that effectively we stop the the influences to get those economic outcomes that actually don't actually work for the majority of people?
Well, that's, first of all, you need the awareness of it. And that's a major reason why I'm very pleased that Victor formed the New Liberals in the first place, because he came with that understanding when he first approached me. I didn't have to lobby him to think about it. He'd already read up on the issue of how money is created and the role of the banks in doing that as well, and what unconstrained bank lending leads to, et cetera, et cetera. And I find the same awareness across the candidates and the other advisors as well. So we're coming from outside the mainstream on that front. And unfortunately, in most places you trust the experts. Economists are not experts on the economy. They're experts on a model of the economy which is fundamentally wrong. So with that awareness in our party, we can hold that together and make that case in Parliament when we get there. But to actually change it, it means you have to say, well, what actually is the legal status of a bank? How does a bank become a bank? And do you become a bank because you're really good at making money? No. Okay. You get a license to make money to become a bank in the first place. And then you find the easiest way to do that is to finance asset speculation. And you can encourage people to take on enormous amounts of debt if they think the asset they're buying with the debt's going to increase in price over time. And you end up in a poisonous situation where we are now, where you have what you've described, I call the political financial complex. So Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, on his way out of being president in America back in 63 or 64, I think, 59, 60, made a comment about the military-industrial complex running America. Well, the politico-financial complex runs Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Victor, from a sort of political leadership perspective, how do you interact, or do you not interact with those big economic dynamos that, of course, the major political parties spend all of their time dancing with?
We don't now. Mm. From a position of powerlessness, we don't now, because for the same reason that we were talking about Rupert Murdoch and his particular monopoly, because they will not treat with us except on their own terms. A politician I know, one of the few truly honest politicians I know, said to me when we were forming this party, mate, you're not going to have any friends. And by that he meant friends in the establishment, in the power base. So, we are taking on the duopoly, we are taking on the fossil fuel industry, the big multinational funders of the duopoly. We're taking on the media apologists for the duopoly. We're taking on the banks, we're taking on everybody. How do you do that? Well, you have to create true populist politics. It's an interesting, you might find it surprising that I use the term populist, because people usually think that means a right-wing approach to politics, but it doesn't. It means appealing to the people rather than the political machine. Now, many of the politicians who've appealed directly to the people have been, like Trump, right-wing. But, they can be left-wing, like Macron, or they can be us. We have to defeat this massive politico-economic machine with the power of the people. We have to have that machine thrown out at the ballot box by the voters. And I'm just crazy enough to think that can be done.
Right. So it's power of the people, right? It really is. It's getting, if you like, people beginning to understand that there is there are alternatives, firstly, right? And secondly...
I think this is actually something you spoke about earlier about it. How on earth do we end up with the politicians we've got? What's actually led to that? And there's actually a very interesting American historian who develops what he calls Clio dynamics and talks about how the Clio being a goddess of history from, I think, from Greek times, about how over time you get elite competition dominating a system. So when you start off, you have wide open slather fundamentally, and then after a while, you get the number of people competing for a particular position in power to be far more than the number of positions available, and you start getting the sort of tribalism we see developing, where it's Labor versus Liberal, meaning my tribe versus your tribe, not meaning different principles of how one should run the economy versus each other. So we've got to that point, and the result is you get incompetent narcissists with a tribal allegiance above all else, deciding how you run a country, and sitting back on the outside looking and saying, this stinks. And therefore, people who are, retired or should be retired, myself and Victor, and plenty of small business people and some trade union people and so on, are saying, enough, we've got to kick them out. And so all these non-career politicians are becoming the political actors of the new Liberal Party to attempt to end this tendency to corruption that the current system has given us.
Mm. Now let's move the conversation on just a little bit to the cop-out 26, as I call it, right? because I think it showed just how far we are from where we need to be able to take seriously what needs to be done to be able to deal with probably the biggest challenge that we all face. So Victor, you've already said this is a really critical thing, the whole question of climate change and what have you. Where does that fit in your sort of policy suite? And, what was your reaction to COP26? And then I'll come to Steve, because I know, Steve, that you've done a lot of work on this and it's in your book. So let's start with you, Victor, first.
The whole thing was pretty unimpressive, I thought. Of all the unimpressive things that seemed to come out of it, our Prime Minister was the most unimpressive. I don't know. I didn't really like much of what I saw, but it is the greatest challenge that we have, and the analogy of a war is often used, and I think that's a perfect analogy. We're fighting the greatest battle we've ever had to fight. We've had a net zero emissions by 2035 policy for a long time, and recently we've reduced it to net zero emissions by 2030 because we're convinced by all the people who are saying so and the logic they bring to bear on that it's a climate crisis. The crazy thing is that the first chance we'll get, unless we get a significant holding of the balance of power and can start blackmailing a minority government into doing something about climate change, the first real chance we'll have is if we can form government in 2025, which would give us 5 years to solve the problem. But it can be done. It is not beyond the ken of human beings to do anything they want to do if we allow those with the genius to step forward, and we foster them through proper government leadership and investment. I think it can be done, and I think it must be done, and I think we want to be the world leaders on this. I'm sick of, everyone is sick of our country being the embarrassment of the developed world. And not just the developed world and the undeveloped world in terms of attacking climate change. I would like to just turn that completely on its head and become the world leaders so that when we go to whatever the climate conference is in World Climate Conference in 2028, we can say, guess what, guys, we've only been in government for 3 years. But we're right on track to get net zero emissions by 2030. And probably when we say that, a similar thing will be said by the Scandinavian countries who all have similar targets. And then you shame the world into doing something about it. Because until somebody actually steps up with a bold plan, it's too easy for people to talk about, oh, but this little part is too difficult and that little part is too difficult. You need somebody to sweep away all that detail and say, you know, it's a bit like if Churchill said, oh, well, we might fight them on the beaches if we can, but it might be a bit expensive. And so we probably won't fight them on the beach, but we might fight them in the streets, sort of, if we can, you know. Oh, no, we probably won't be able to. Let's surrender, you know. Like if you need a Churchillian attempt to stand, a Churchillian way of standing up and saying this needs to be done so it'll bloody well be done, you know. And when somebody does that, and I hope it's us, I hope we get the opportunity to do that, the world will go, yes, yes, this modest country, you know, on the southern tip of this planet has done it. Maybe we should do it too, so we can live with ourselves and so we can live with the fact that we need to bequeath something to our children and grandchildren other than a burning planet.
So it sounds like there's a leadership theme coming through there, right? We've got to lead. We can't just sort of, you know, vaguely follow and avoid any hard decisions, right?
I get really sick of this idea that Australia is a tiny country that can't possibly lead. Mm. I mean, I was talking to it's a little off the topic, but it's kind of analogous and makes the point, I hope. I was talking to a very senior military person who just said to me flat, Australia can't defend itself, you know? Well, if you're a military leader and you say Australia can't defend itself, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you say, yes, we'll bloody well make sure it does defend itself, you know, then it will. And if, you know, like there's almost nothing in this world that can't happen if the political will is there. The problem with this country and a lot of the Western world is that the political will hasn't been there. Well, there's been a will to drive all the income and the wealth to the top 1%, and that will has been fulfilled spectacularly well, but there's been a very little will to do anything else. So, yes, I do think it's about leadership. I think we're lacking leadership. And, you know, with all due humility, Steve and I and others within the party, we want to provide that leadership because we're not looking over our shoulder to see if our career is being enhanced by this or that. We're just old farts going in there, you know, swinging some axes. And hopefully we'll get it done that way.
Mm, okay, good. Well, I'll come out in a second. Just let me say there's a couple of questions in the chat room from Jason and from Smooth. I will come to it. I just want to have this conversation first. So I am watching what's going on in the chat, but I can't do everything at the same time. So the two observations. The first observation is there is a whole possibility of a bunch of new jobs that have actually aligned to effectively creating the new economy, right? An economy based on, you know, a different set of approaches which actually takes us towards where we want to get to. So it's not like there's a zero alternative. There is an alternative. There is a practical alternative. The second point seems to me that it is ridiculous banking on unknown technologies for the bulk of the mitigations that we're actually championing at the moment, right? And then going and using offsets, in other words, buying effectively carbon credits from around the world to be able to actually make the maths work, right? That is, to my mind, deceptive, firstly. It's not going to get us to where we need to get to. But it is the way that the omelette is being spun at the moment. So you've got to have a different set of platforms to be able to really make what we want to achieve achievable.
Yeah, well, we adopted, there's a wonderful paper by ClimateWorks, sponsored by the Meyer Foundation and Monash University a couple of years ago, where they set out in great detail how you can get to net zero emissions by 2050, or if you ramp up all the various details by 2030. And that that is a wonderful paper, and it's fundamentally what we just adopted as our policy. And it doesn't require carbon credits, it doesn't require taxes, it doesn't require any of that stuff. It works beautifully with what they have. And yeah, I agree with you completely, Martin. It's deceptive, it's dangerous. It gives It gives opponents of climate change and supporters of fossil fuel the old Tony Abbott opportunity of screaming tax, you know, another big tax or something. Just not necessary. Forget it, you know. Mm. Let's harness. See, we've got so much amazing intellect in this country. Frustrated people. I meet frustrated geniuses every day. Well, Steve Keen's one of them, you know, who have these amazing visions for our country. And all they need is, you know, someone like myself to turn a button, twist a knob, you know, completely unskilled, but say, yeah, I like what you guys are doing and you're doing it well and you've got some solutions. It's not like we don't have solutions. We're awash in solutions. If you read widely within this country, let alone internationally, we're awash in wonderful solutions to every one of our problems. Job guarantee schemes, modern monetary theory, climate change solutions, you know, on and on and on, defense solutions, but they just don't get adopted. I mean, I won't go on too long, but one of the great solutions to the problems with urban development is a paper that was commissioned by this government. It was one of those things where they didn't really want anything to happen, so they sent it to committee, but the backbenchers who were responsible for it commissioned some great stuff from some great people, and they have come up with a wonderful urban solution, which we will probably, you know, take on as our own, because the current government will never use it. So there's stuff everywhere, even within the corridors of power, and it just needs to be, you know, someone needs to hold up a green flag and say, there you go.
Absolutely, and see me come to queue. Cop-out 26?
Yeah, total cop-out. But the reason, the question is, why does it cop-out? And the thing is that most people, including those making decisions about what we do, don't understand what climate change actually means. They literally think it means it's going to get a bit warmer in most of the world. And, you know, and I remember sitting through an economics presentation back when I was doing my master's degree with some highfalutin famous English economist. We were all dragged out and go and see at the John Clancy Auditorium at the University of New South Wales. And this turkey came out and said, well, if it gets warmer, I'll wear one less cardigan. And that is literally the way in which economists have interpreted this. And, of course, they've set up how people think about climate change. So, yeah, you know, we're going to save a cardigan, big deal. What is actually going on is a change to the structure of the weather circulatory systems of the planet. And I can give no better example of what this can be than the work of the person who discovered the ozone hole in the ozone layer and then partly led the campaign to close that coal over Antarctica. If you remember the ozone layer experience of the late 1900s. He said in an interview back in 2015 that if we lose the Arctic, and we're going to lose it in the next 5 to 15 years, there'll be no more summer sea ice in the Arctic. That will change the temperature difference between the equator and the pole, such that moisture will get into the stratosphere. And I have no idea how it will happen. He just said it will. And he said the consequence of that will be that there will be an even temperature distribution between the equator and the North Pole, what's called the equable Earth outcome, which means that the pole will have a temperature of about 20 degrees Celsius, okay? And that will mean in turn, and this is his own specialization in ozone research, that the water that gets into the stratosphere will also take with it carbon, fluorocarbons, chlorine, et cetera, which will destroy the ozone layer. Now, that does, living in the Northern Territory, the Northern Hemisphere, will not be an option. That's the sort of thing we need by climate change, not, you know, a few degrees warmer, but stuff which can actually threaten the existence of life on the planet. Now, if you have this trivialized idea that it's just making some parts warmer and then changing what's the optimal temperature for a country, then you can see this is something which, you know, it's worth you fighting to hang on to your coal industry. No, it's not, if the coal industry is going to wipe out life in the Northern Hemisphere. Indirectly, through what the increase in temperature will do to moisture, which it will do to carbon, you know, chlorofluorocarbons. So it's that lack of awareness of the actual mechanics and what they can mean for life on the planet that has led to us trivialising it, and therefore COP25 becomes COP26 becomes a cop out.
Right. So, and there was almost no discussion of those, fundamentally structural changes which you're talking about, and certainly some of the reading I've done would suggest that you're spot on there. It was almost like, well, we'll fight over 1.5 versus 2.1 or whatever, right? That became the battleground, but that's not really the battleground, is it?
Well, the battleground is a biosphere which life can survive.
Yeah.
And we don't realise how fragile that is. And I think the best analogy people can think of it themselves is, what if somebody told you, I'm going to make you 3 degrees warmer? As in, I'm going to raise your temperature from 36.5 to 39.5. Yeah. Does that sound like a good idea to you? You'll be in hospital very shortly of heat stroke. And in that sense, the entire planet is a living system, which... And the species, the creatures on it, and certainly our civilization, evolved for the current range, which was set by a carbon dioxide level of about 280 parts per million. Mm. We're now crashed well past 400. We've now got other chemicals adding to that. Many other forms of pollution we're causing as well. This is making the biosphere non-viable for us.
Yeah.
And if we don't stop it, we're not going to exist. So,
and that's the point, Steve, isn't it?
Not optimization.
Yeah, this is not about saving the planet, right? The planet will always be there, right?
Yeah.
What it is saving our ability to stay on the planet.
Exactly, yeah.
Right?
I mean, the dinosaurs didn't survive the meteor, but they can't be blamed for causing the meteor in the first instance.
Exactly right, yeah. No, okay. Now, as we come close to our 9:30 deadline, because I don't want to... We could go on all night. I've got loads of questions here, but there was a couple that came earlier. Let's put this one back up. I think it's for you, Steve. A lot of interest in... If you lifted interest rates, say, 7 up to 7 or 15%, would that neutralise the gain in house prices as you'd have to pay more? Does speculation, in other words, is really lifting interest rates a policy? Now, you said earlier on, no, because people can't afford it.
Yeah, if interest rates don't control speculation when it's rising. And if you've actually at the aftermath to it, when the household sector in Australia has a debt level of 120% plus of GDP, if you've imposed interest rates of 15%, then you'd be looking at 20% of GDP just to service your mortgage. Well, everybody with a mortgage would be bankrupt, including high-rise Harry. So you'd be crashing the financial system to save it. And there's no, first of all, it would be disastrous if it was tried. And secondly, nobody's going to try it because as soon as they do, house prices start falling and they'll drop interest rates once more. So you have to find a cleverer way to do that. And that's what the modern debt jubilee is about. It's a clever way to, you have to reduce the debt first before you can reduce you've got to get rid of the debt rather than try to raise the interest on the debt.
Yeah, great. Thanks for that. Now, as we come towards the end, a few people wanted to know, Victor, your thoughts on migration and also on the lockdowns. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm a immigration barrister, a refugee barrister, and so I watch this on a daily basis. And there's a terrible situation that has arisen. Where a simple situation has been played upon by both sides of politics to create fear in people's minds and demonise one of the most downtrodden parts, if not the most downtrodden part of society and the world in order to get political gain. We want to get it back to people understanding this very simple fact that we're a party to the Refugee Convention. That convention says that if somebody turns up in your country, it doesn't matter how they turn up, and they seek asylum from you on the basis that they have a well-founded fear of persecution for various reasons in their home country, then they should be put through the system, and we have a system of tribunals and courts. It's an antiquated system, and we want to make that better. That's another question, but nonetheless, it's a system, and it's a system that works. They get put through that system. If they're found to be a genuine refugee, we give them protection. If they're not found to be a genuine refugee, we're equally obliged to send them home. Now, it's as simple as that. And people particularly politicians, obfuscate this to the nth degree to create fear and apprehension, because it's very easy to create fear and apprehension when it comes to refugees, because you pick up on the atavistic nature of human beings, going right back to the most primitive times when you had a village of 30 people that were scratching to keep themselves alive. They could barely live from day to day on their hunting and their gathering. Some stranger who's been thrown out of their own village turns up and says, can I stay in your village? And they panic. They say, we can barely feed ourselves. We take in one more mouth. We're all going to starve. So they turn him away. Now, that's not an appropriate way to think in the modern world. But politicians know that if you play on that atavistic fear, you should get some sort of political credit for it. Now, what we've seen develop in recent times is that this government and previous governments have created a situation where Peter Dutton was, there's no actual figures on this, so this is my estimates as a refugee barrister. Peter Dutton spending about, well, we do have figures that he's spending, I keep saying Peter Dutton because he's now gone as immigration minister, but he's the force behind all evil in that party as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, what he did as immigration minister was that he spent $4 billion a year putting people in prison, both on the mainland of Australia and Manus and Nauru. And in my estimate, he spent another $4 billion keeping every possible refugee he could out of the country. And at the same time, allowed in what I would respectfully say was a large number of inappropriate non-refugee immigrants to grow the economy and have that wonderful GDP graph going off into the stratosphere. And it really, what we want to do is put it the other way around, limit non-refugee immigration to an appropriate number for what this country and these urban centres can sustain, whilst opening our hearts. And people should not interpret that to mean opening our borders to anyone, opening our hearts to those who claim status, refugee status, and meet the legal requirements to have it. That's a very small number of people compared to the number of immigrants of other sorts that are let in. It's back the front, and we want to also eliminate the invidious situation where people can be put behind bars now. And this was another thing rushed through with the cooperation of the Labor Party. Now, at the whim of the Minister for Immigration, for the rest of their lives. In other words, the minister now has the power, in contravention of our international obligation, to send a proven refugee back to their death, but if their country won't take them, to then put them in jail in Australia for the rest of their lives. And this is one of the worst things that the world has seen since slavery and apartheid and the Holocaust. And I don't want to resolve from that. And people tell me I'm crazy talking about that. There's no votes in that. You'll terrify people. Well, so be it. You know, we're human beings and we want to treat other human beings as human beings. And that's what we stand for. You'll get, Martin, you'll get quite a few comments saying that's a bad idea, but it's what we are.
Yeah, there's a very active chat session. I'm missing a few questions, I have to tell you, because there were just so many there, and I haven't necessarily been able to follow all of them. But there is interesting thematic coming through about this idea about private debt causes. This is from actually. Whoa, go there. Hang on, put that one up there. Okay, here we are. Private debt causes speculation, so would higher interest rates be better and stop the problem? It's a sort of the same question and asked in a different way. I think, Steve, your earlier answer would probably still be the same answer, right?
Yeah, I mean, if people have an idea of how high that debt level is, if I could just grab the screen for a second and show what that amounts to in the Australian setting. I just... Anyway, this is a software I'm developing at the moment for modelling, for analysing data. This is the level of private debt in Australia from 1950 through to 2020. And what you've got is gone from about 60% of GDP to 200% of GDP. And that's a large reason why interest rates have fallen. And the booms and busts of the economy have been driven by the change in private debt. This is the credit level down here. This line here is zero. So we had a negative credit experience back in Paul Keating's, the recession we had to have. And that's the only period of negative credit Australia's had in that period. But we've got a gigantic level of private debt. It's four times the level of government debt, three to four times. And yet we obsess about the government debt level. If you try to put interest rates up when debt's that high, then you're basically handing over the cash flow of the economy to the financial sector. And that's the exact opposite of what we need to do. So I'd rather reduce this debt level, pardon me, reduce the debt level rather than trying to increase interest rates on that debt.
And that's really the point, isn't it? So that you can't just move the interest rates up, because if you do that, then effectively even larger cash flows go back to the finance sector.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the problem with the Australian economy that the finance sector is not getting enough money.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, we're over time, way over time already. Steve, any last thoughts, messages you want to leave with the audience, and I'll come back to Victor and we'll go the same there as well.
I suppose the unexpected message I want is vote for me in New South Wales for the Senate. we have to get in there, and like I really admire Victor for jumping out of the Senate and into the frying pan of the House of Reps in the attempt to get the North Sydney seat and have the leader of the party actually in the House of Reps, where you ultimately the political power does reside. The best I can do is try to get the party into the Senate, where we at least can get our voices into the discussion, if not have the balance of power. So that's the message. I've never thought I'd say vote for me, but I'm now saying vote for me, vote for the new Liberals, and vote to get rid of the duopoly and particularly the corrupt Morrison government that's making the country a laughing stock.
Great. And Victor?
Well, I suppose I've got to say vote for me after that. What I did was, and which made room for Steve to come into the Senate, which is wonderful, is I realised that there was a real chance that as leader of the New Liberals, I could get elected to the lower house in the seat of North Sydney. There's a lot of moderate, disaffected Liberal voters there who are looking for a real Liberal Party. There are disenchanted Labor and Greens voters who are looking for something progressive to vote for. There's a real chance, and I thought it's a risk. Of course it's a risk, and it's a big risk. But I think if I can do that, first of all, that will carry in a number of other candidates if the leader of the party even looks like he's going to get elected. It's worth doing because we don't have time to spare. You know, we are talking about a net zero emissions by 2030. We've got to get in there. We can't take the leisurely approach of the Democrats or the Greens over 20 or 25 years. And I think the way to do that is to show that we can achieve something in 2 years as a party that took the Greens, for example, 25 years to do, and that is get people into the lower house. And if we do that, it'll crack wide open the duopoly, and we'll be able to make real and effective change. So, yes, I do say vote for me, but more importantly, I say if you live in Sydney and you don't, you know, particularly if you live in the North Sydney electorate or one of the adjoining electorates, or you're willing to travel a bit, come and join the team. We need boots on the ground. We've got a couple of hundred, but we could do with a couple of hundred more. Or if you've got a spare $1 million to donate to the campaign, that would be good too. Any one of those things, please.
but the point, Victor, is this is a point in time, a moment in history, yep. Right, where there is an opportunity to turn the tiller and move in a different direction. Right,
that's it, and I knew that. And that's why I knew that the risk had to be taken, not really wanted to take it, but had to be taken.
Yep.
And so we're taking it, and let's see. Anyone who wants to help that in whatever fashion you choose, love to hear from you.
Well, Victor, thank you very much for your time. Steve, thank you very much for your time. We got through about a third of the questions. So if you want to come back and have another go in a few weeks' time, you'll be more than welcome, because I think that people are very appreciative of your openness and transparency discussing these critical issues. And a lot of people here are trying to understand what's really going on. So, and we had 2,444 playbacks. That's wow. pretty amazing. So well done, guys. That's
that's
we broke the, we broke your record.
You broke the record. Yes, exactly yeah, right. Okay. So congratulations, and it shows that there is a high level of interest in this in this topic and the things around it. So,
I'm going to with another plug there. And like, if people want to help, but this is really is a grassroots campaign. We're literally raising our money through GoFundMe campaigns and things like that. Go to the newliberals.net.au website. Help out if you can. Financial, of course, is great, but bums on seats that can actually hand out leaflets on election day, that's vital as well. Tell your friends. This has to be a grassroots campaign, so please assist us and help us kick the duopoly out of power.
And Martin, honestly, thank you so much for having us on, and your support is absolute gold. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to have you on. You know, I'm, as I said before we started, I'm frustrated with how things are. I believe things need to change, and there is a way of making the change go in the right direction. And so if I can be part of that through through DFA, then so far as I'm concerned, that's goodness, right? So keep up the good work, and thank you both very much for your time. I'm going to take you both offline now, and I'll just close out the show. So thank you both very much, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Cheers.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, there we are, folks. I hope you enjoyed that. That was quite something. Of course, we never get to all the questions. I do apologise in advance, but hopefully we got the main ones. If there's an opportunity to get them back, I'll try and see what we can do. Just before I close, I will just tell you that next week, a bit of a change of pace, I've got Michael on, and he's going to talk with me about options and how they work, and you know, do they work, don't they work. I used to teach options years ago. Michael's quite interested in that stuff, and he actually runs a firm, Emerald Financial, around it. So that should be quite interesting. Very different flavor, but that might be worth coming and spending some time with us. And I want to say thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening, and I hope you found it inspirational, useful. Please like and share the post, and I'll see you next week. So this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.